downloaded from the internet, so he's rather pixelated. He's up there. Here's a better image of him. On his little planet. So I'll let you contemplate this for a while I introduce our subject. The subject for today's conversation is that elusive essence at the very center of our sense of aliveness, something we call innocence, and that we associate with the guileless simplicity and wide-eyed trust of children, or the equally compelling beauty and presence of those special animals that we call pets. Whether child or animal, innocence implies a virginal state connoting something pure, original, uncontaminated by the grown-up or civilized world of adult experience, something close to the soul and to one's spiritual inheritance, as James Grotstein said in the quote I gave you yesterday. Remember, he said, innocence is the central element in a person's spiritual life. Now, psychoanalysis has not been friendly to the idea of innocence. The child, according to Freud's vision, was polymorphously perverse, a bundle of instincts striving for release and discharge. The same could be said for Melanie Klein and her followers, who adhered to the concept that the infant came into life with unconscious destructive fantasies deriving from the death instinct, which were projected onto the mother and then feared as rebounding persecution and attack. For Klein, one did not start with innocence, but with guilt, a kind of psychoanalytic version of original sin. These things work their way down, you know, into even scientific theories, original sin. It's so deep in the Western, psyche. The child then, according to Klein, worked through a process of projective identification and reintrojection through that process towards gratitude, moving, as Klein said, from the paranoid persecutory to the depressive position. Those of you who know this language will be reminded of these ideas. However, many other psychoanalysts who both preceded and followed Klein did not share this view, and recent developments in the field, particularly attachment theory, infant observation, relational theory, self-psychology of Heinz Kohut, and the relational school in New York, of which Stephen Mitchell, Philip Bromberg, and others are primary representatives, all support a more sympathetic view of primal innocence in the child's infancy. And members of the British Object Relations School, which have been so important to me in my own personal development, particularly Winnicott, Guntrip, Fairbairn, all clearly imply an initial condition of childhood innocence which can then be violated or corrupted by environmental failure. Through this theoretical lens, the innocent infant is hostage to a facilitating environment or not, to the early maternal connection, which needs to be good enough, not perfect, definitely not perfect, because otherwise there would be no rough edges through which that innocent child would descend into experience, but good enough. Winnicott said, you get a self through two channels. One is libido, love, and the other is aggression, hate. And in the love channel, you've got to have those experiences with the mother in which you both find and create the experience in transitional intermediate space. I gave you that example last night or the day before. In the aggression channel, the child has to ruthlessly be able to attack the frustrating mother who sets boundaries and says no, and to find out that the mother survives the attack. Winnicott's endearing sort of little vignette is the infant says, "Hello, object. I thought I destroyed you." Now I see you've survived my destruction of you. Now I can go on destroying you in fantasy and love you in reality. The idea being that the infant's fantasy of destructiveness is so terrifying and so overwhelming and yet so compulsive and so instinctual that the infant must aggress against the partner in the early maternal situation and must then discover that reality is strong enough to hold the imagination and that the two then together can enrich life. Jung, you remember, was very fond of building towers and destroying them as a boy. So those are the two ways in which we slowly come into our connection to reality. James Grotstein makes an even more sympathetic, even eloquent case for primal childhood innocence in his book, Who's the Dreamer That Dreams the Dream? And Who's the Dreamer That Remembers It? That was a book in 2000 that he wrote. It has not been well reviewed by his colleagues in the psychoanalytic world, but it's a huge and eloquent, very Jungian statement. He says, innocence signifies the child's sense of being blessed and protected by its objects and thus anticipating safety in its life and in its wanderings. It suggests guilelessness of anticipation of experience, openness. Whereas loss of innocence occurs with the collapse of its faith and the trust in its objects when they either critically disappoint, neglect, or abuse the infant, or when random circumstances traumatically cause the infant to believe that the world is unsafe. These infants then become what he calls orphans of the real. It's quite a statement, orphans of the real. So we're really saying that that pristine innocence, those sparks of the divine, I love this phrase by Rilke, pollen of the flowering Godhead. We all contain that pollen of the flowering Godhead. And then the question is, given that we come in with that connection and all of the implications of it, the beauty, the pleromatic oneness experiences, and the inflation, then we have to find ways of coming down into our own human particularity of ego development. So I'm really trying to interest you and other audiences that I'm talking to here that in the idea that if you take a psycho-spiritual position, as I'm trying to do here, then you have to talk about two lines of development. You have to talk about how we all, as individuals, grow up. The ego develops, it develops agency, it develops a conflict-free sphere in which it can negotiate the world of reality. But the God-identified soul has to grow down. Now, the Christian theological word for this was kenosis, and it was applied to the Christ figure, who was understood to have been required to empty himself. Kenosis means to empty. He emptied himself of his divine plenitude in order to become human in particular, all the way down to suffering a mortal death. That was the idea. So while the ego grows up, the God-identified soul grows down. And it's interruptions in that process that we are talking about in the world of trauma. And one of the things that will be trying to interest you in today is the idea that when trauma ruptures that mutual process, what tends to happen is that the early structure that we're talking about is the infantile self, the core of the self, gets stuck in the unconscious. And inevitably, it's one of its problems is that it is inflated. It hasn't had that experience of being companioned and mediated into particularity. It hasn't suffered That's what Jung meant by authentic suffering, the necessary suffering that's a part of descending into reality. Now, Margaret Arden, who's an analyst in London, makes a case for the primacy of childhood innocence when she says, quote, "For me, the transformation produced by insight in the consulting room is symbolically equivalent to the spiritual journey towards enlightenment. Psychoanalysis is a new version of an ancient theme shared by all the great religions. The loss of illusion, the giving up of attachment to a false reality, the inevitability of suffering, and expiation are all present in psychoanalysis. Every person who seeks analysis is on a personal pilgrimage. The Christian maxim, quote, unless you become like little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven, is my marker of the true self. False self-behavior is usually manipulative and destructive of psychic truth. All our theories can be seen as ways of unraveling the destructive processes or defenses, we saw those last night, which the patient uses. The miracle of psychoanalysis, and it is a miracle, is that when a person comes to understand the core of his or her childhood experiences, all the anger and defensiveness, all the rejection of life, turns out to have been for one purpose, to preserve at whatever cost the child who is capable of love. To preserve at whatever cost the child who is capable of love. I can give you the reference later if you want. So, you know, psychoanalysis is not so bleak when it comes to its attitude towards innocence. I'm trying to lubricate my voice box early in this conversation so that I can complete it. Now, for the next little bit, before we get to our story of the Little Prince, I want to try to just simply connect some of the metaphors that I've been using. We're talking about, you know, rather difficult and different things. I'm using the image of hell as a encapsulated space, effectively representing the unconscious of the traumatized person. And today, I'll be using the image of heaven, that is to say, the little prince on his planet, as an analogy to that place in hell called limbo. So I'm going to try to help you just see what I'm trying to talk about. I'm trying to talk about a split condition, what the unconscious looks like in the traumatized individual. And in each case, there's this segmentation between a child part and the innocent part of us and the defenses which help us to survive. And we're just using different metaphors. But before we get to those particular metaphors, let's look at this picture of the creation of Adam by Michelangelo on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Here are the two worlds. We can think of these as the two worlds. The world of the divine on the right and the world of the human on the left. Now, what's interesting about this is that the hands don't touch. There's a synapse. And that synapse is the synapse we're talking about in this conference, the space between the worlds. Now, what do we understand now belongs in that synapse? Well, I'll just give you a few of the things we've talked about so far. Art, dreams, stories, the mythopoetic, the transference, the transference in psychoanalytic thought, transitional space. All of these are images of the recent thing that Thomas Ogden's talking about all the time is the analytic third. He says the two partners in the in the analytic dialogue, create the analytic third. And then he says, and the two partners are created by the analytic third. Very mystical statement. Completely undefensible. From a materialistic scientific point of view, right? But he's right about that. He's absolutely right about that. When you have that experience, and all of you have had it, there's a magic moment of understanding or rapport or connection, and you know that you've been met by something bigger than both of you in that moment. And it's that something bigger is something that we often project onto the partner. Jung called it the anima, the soul, the animus, the soul. We have to be careful about that because we're only human carriers of that magic. On the other hand, without us, there wouldn't be any magic. So we have to be both careful and honoring of what happens when we fall in love, when we meet that special other, when we find ourselves enthralled, entranced. So we're talking about this fabulous gap. And remember, my comment the other day was trauma forecloses transitional space. So trauma closes this gap. All the flow across this gap stops. It reminds me of a story. We were in Ephesus in Turkey, and there was an old Asclepian temple there where the warriors came to be treated for their trauma. First thing the warriors had to do was run 100 yards. They didn't have to run well. Some of them crawled, but they made it 100 yards. Then they were ritually cleansed and bathed and put in a sleep chamber and given soporific drugs so that they could sleep and recover. They were also told to pay attention to their dreams, especially to their dreams of Asclepius and his snake. After a period of time, they came up from underground and they became part of the audience to a play. And the play was put on by the doctors. This is medicine. And the physicians who were performing the play, and the play had a lot of strong drama and feeling in it. And there were up on the stage, there were witnesses who would watch the trauma survivors in the audience and to observe whether or not they were reacting with a full response to the affect in the drama that was being portrayed. And if they were reacting with feeling, if they were crying in the parts that were genuinely sad, if they were laughing in the parts that were genuinely funny, they were understood to be healed or on the way to healing.